Bert Chubel, Northwestern. Marinus, I just want to comment briefly about the upper motor neuron findings. We've seen several post-polio patients who had upper motor neuron findings manifested as increased reflexes or Babinski signs, and I would say it's less than 5% of the patients we see. And at least based on experimental studies, I mean, it's clear that, you know, poliovirus can infect upper motor neurons, so it doesn't surprise me too much that this is, occasionally seen. Also, if you look at the human literature on poliomyelitis, you'll find described upper motor neuron findings in some of those patients who had early in their course of polio. Now, I don't know why I've seen a few of these and you haven't. I was talking to Dr. Mulder earlier, and it may well be that some of the patients that we see are actually referred with the question, do they have ALS, rather than the question of post-polio. I don't know if that explains it, and I know other people have seen upper motor neuron signs, although several here in the audience haven't. But the way we can, usually these patients have a very slow course, their EMG does not look like ALS with a lot of denervation, even though if you looked at them at one point in time, they have both upper and lower motor neuron signs and no evidence of cord compression on like MRI or myelographic studies.
Yeah, but I agree entirely. I think your speculation that these patients had the upper motor neuron signs or some of the upper motor neurons have been affected during the original illness may explain these findings. We did not find in up to 60 patients or more that we have examined, but our patients didn't really come to see if they have ALS. Perhaps it's a sampling, it's the population that we have checked. I guess it happens, it can happen. But your point is also very interesting. If you have followed these patients a number of years and they really don't develop, they just have perhaps PPMA with upgoing toes without anything else. So I think that's important to know.
I'm Donald Mulder. I would just like to add just one word to that. We did have some in our original series that who did have upgoing toes. They were referred to us as ALS. We had problems with those patients because so many of them had such serious illness with multiple surgical procedures on their legs and feet that it gets to be very hard to sort out when the upgoing toe is meaningful, when the muscles, or when it's just because of unusual musculature. And I guess we weren't completely certain about that when we finished. I would think it's perfectly possible that some patients could have two diseases, as we heard earlier, or surely patients that we saw early on had involvement of the cerebrum in addition to the anterior horn cells.
Sorry, thank you.
Jack Antel. Marinos, your observations about the spinal fluid immunoglobulin raise a number of complicated questions, and namely related to whether an animal or a human having an acute viral encephalitis, once there's an initial immune response, in fact, retains evidence of that indefinitely, and I think the prototype for that is probably mumps meningoencephalitis. What is known about the development, if at all, about an acute polio, if anyone has had a chance to look at spinal fluid in terms of an immune response, and does that persist indefinitely? I think that's important in terms of the questions that are raised about second infections or post-viral syndrome superimposed on polio, as to whether this is really a new immune response or not. And perhaps I could ask Burke Jubel to comment as well. Burke, in animal models with your viral encephalitis or others that Diane Griffin and others have worked with, once an immune response is seen, especially an immunoglobulin response or oligoclonal bands, does that ever disappear?
In the animals, it seems to persist in the spinal fluid and in the nervous system over a long period of time. You know, obviously this hasn't been looked at in a lot of detail in humans, but at least in the animal models, it seems to persist.
Yeah, Jack, you're really raising a very important question, and we have been trying to answer that question because we noted oligoclonal banding in these patients 3 years ago. So I was desperately looking for acute polio. And as you know, it's very difficult or almost impossible to get acute polio in this country. So I have been even thinking to travel to India where there is polio, or to travel to other countries, South Africa, where there is polio, just to do a spinal tap, to really get some to get this information because it's a very important information. But what we managed to do is we got up to 9 spinal fluids from Taiwan where there was a recent epidemic. And these spinal fluids have traveled a lot, and they are negative for banding. Now, I have one reservation there. This is not a fresh spinal fluid. It was drawn after was sent to us through from Taiwan. It took about 2 days or 3 days sometimes to come. So I don't know if it's a matter of preservation or not. But in these 9 patients that we have looked, they did not have banding.
Marinos, the banding that you did find in these patients, have you looked to see if it's directed against poliovirus antigens at all?
We're trying to do that now, Bert. Yeah.
Cut you off. I'm going to try and keep us to no longer than a half hour if I can here behind. Dr. Patton is next. We'll hear from him, and we still have more time for discussion. I think this will be related.
Well, I want to thank Laura for inviting me. This talk is divided into 3 parts, and the first part, I'm sort of going to complement the talk that you just heard and talk about the relationship of post-polio to ALS. Then I'm just going to review briefly a suggested workup for the post-polio syndrome, since I think it is a syndrome and we don't really know all that much about it. I think every patient should be studied in detail. And then I want to report our case data on 7 patients that we've studied for about a decade. We had the advantage of studying these patients with quantitative methods, grip strength, head holding, and leg holding times. And every time the patient saw me, these tests were done. So we have longitudinal data on the patients that is quite quantitative. And it has been computerized, and some interesting correlations have come out of that analysis. Now, to start off, I want to state my conclusions first so that those of you who wish to fall asleep may those off and not miss much. And those of you who want to stay awake can see if the conclusions are justified by the data presented. The conclusions are that ALS and post-polio syndrome are related only by a superficial clinical and laboratory resemblance, and they differ mainly in prognosis, with ALS progressing rapidly and post-polio progressing at a uniform rate of about -7% per year per person. And that rate appears to be uniform for right and left grip, head holding, and leg holding. So in our data, it looks like it's a uniform affecting all muscles. My second conclusion is that each and every patient needs a detailed workup because you may find other treatable things that are adversely affecting motor neuron function, and I'll attempt to illustrate that. The third conclusion from our computerized data is that the single most important controlling variable determining post-polio syndrome is, guess what? The occurrence of polio at an early age, before age 5. In fact, that event predicts what we find in a muscle biopsy. And the last point is that we have found that there are many patients that have multiple evidence for autoimmunity. And we think this may be a major point. Dr. DeLakis has found this too. And we have taken it one step further with treatment of some patients with prednisone and Cytoxan. Now, to start off with part one, I think Dr. DeLakis actually reviewed the clinical picture and how it differs in the two syndromes. I just want to go over some of the history. The first mention of this syndrome as related to anything is in 1875 with Charcot discussing a case presented by Raymond. That patient had polio at age 6 months and had a paralyzed left side of the body, and then at age 17, developed a paralyzed right side, slowly progressive. There was a review in 1903 by Potts, and of the 35 patients discussed there, 2 of them had upper and lower motor neuron signs and looked like they had ALS. There were reviews in 1935 by Salmon and Riley, a review in 52, and a famous paper in 62 by Zilker. Up to the Zilker paper in 62, there were 83 patients reported in the literature, and several things emerged from those case reports. The first thing was that post-polio occurred in people who had early polio before age 5. There were 3 exceptions. Geyers had 2 cases that had polio at age 32 and 15, and Campbell had a patient with polio at age 21. The second important point was that post-polio is very slowly progressive compared to ALS. In fact, there's no comparison in the rate of progression. And the third point was that bulbar signs, including fasciculations of the tongue, may occur in post-polio, but do not presage a poor prognosis the way they may presage a poor prognosis in ALS. That brings us to 1972 and the now classic paper of Dr. Mulder, and he should correct me if I misstate any of his data, but he reported 34 patients with excellent criteria for selection. 25 of the 34 had fasciculations, 4 had Babinski signs, and 2 additional patients had equivocal Babinski signs. Their major conclusion was that the ALS and post-polio syndrome are different in regard to prognosis, and also they mentioned that the incidence of lateral column signs, lateral spinal column signs, is less in post-polio syndrome than ALS, but the two conditions can overlap, and you can have patients with clinical and laboratory features that look similar. That brings us to the famous paper of Dr. Delakis, with which all students of post-polio syndrome must be familiar. And I'll mention that he reported in the New England Journal paper 27 patients with a rate of progression of 1% per year. 7 of the 13 had oligoclonal bands, and 12 of the 27 had inflammation. And he made a big point about the scattered angular fibers and not grouping of angular fibers. Now, as far as the epidemiology of polio in ALS is concerned, there is the report by Postcanser in which he studied 196 patients and predicted that the incidence of ALS patients giving a history of polio should be 0.6, and yet he found 5 cases. He said that the p-value was significant at p equals 0.001, and this meant that there was an increased incidence of ALS patients reporting early polio. When Pierce Rulin and I did our case control study of ALS, we interviewed 88 patients and asked them to name their control. The control had to be a patient of the same sex and age that grew up in their childhood environment. And in that group, we found that there were 5 patients in the ALS group who had a history of polio in their youth, and there were none of 78 control patients. We're only able to match 78. So we thought this indicated that there was an increased incidence of reported polio in the history of ALS patients. Now, going back over our data, and we cannot go over Postcanser's data, and reviewing the 5 patients that we reported to have ALS and polio, we would not presently include those as ALS patients, but instead would include those as post-polio syndrome. So if we had a redo, or were able to redo our study and republish it, we would now say that we had 83 patients, and none of them had a history of polio, and 78 controls, and none of them had a history, and that there was no increased incidence of a history of polio among ALS patients. This illustrates L.P. Hartley's statement about the past being a different country. They do things differently, and we would have done things differently if we could go back. So putting the review of the literature together, I think it's very clear that ALS and post-polio are not related. They're not related because post-polio has a history of polio and ALS doesn't. Post-polio is slowly progressive and ALS is quickly progressive. Clinical signs and symptoms do overlap, but the incidence of lateral column involvement is much less in the post-polio than in ALS. May I have the first slide? This just illustrates the data matrix for our patients. And the way the computer organizes the variables, we're able to look at all the variables that we want to, up to 200 variables, using the statistical package for the social sciences. This is how some of the correlations come off the computer printout, and we were able to show that there are some correlations. We agree with Dr. Munsa that sometimes you can get spurious correlations, and we and I will only talk about correlations that were significant at the 0.001 level, okay? We'll talk about those later. And this is some of the way we organize the data. The initial right grip and the final right grip were positively correlated in each and every patient at a p less than 0.001. The final left grip and the final right grip were also positive, the final leg holding and the final right grip. In other words, all the measurements correlate with each other in an individual patient. The variable first is the year in which the polio occurred, and that correlated with the incidence of atrophic type 1 fibers on biopsy and atrophic type 2 fibers on biopsy and necrosis of fibers. These are some of the tests that we would recommend for screening post-polio patients. We believe in a detailed clinical and laboratory evaluation, looking for everything that might be treatable, and muscle and nerve biopsy, I think, is very important, and magnetic scan of the brain, looking for abnormalities at the cervical cranial junction or syringomyelia or something of that sort. And the utility of this particular technique will be described in my written paper, where we'll report detailed case reports of patients referred with a diagnosis of post-polio or ALS who actually had other conditions that were much more treatable. And this is some of the clinical clues that we might be dealing with a treatable disease. For instance, we had a patient who had ptosis and post-polio who had positive anti-acetylcholine receptor antibodies, a Tensilon test, who now is doing excellent after a decade of treatment. He had thymectomy and he had prednisone therapy. So picking up a patient like that enormously changes the prognosis in a given individual. And I just want to illustrate some of the quantitative data. Here's a rate of progression for a hand grip, right and left. And you see there are variables. This is from 1976 to 86, a decade of study. And this illustrates the kind of general decline that may occur with some blips up. Other patients may stabilize or actually improve. And you see how this happens, and note the asymmetry of involvement. More of the same. I want to skip ahead to, on the muscle biopsies that we've done, we've found that two of our seven patients have lipid inclusions, and four of our seven patients have consistently elevated triglyceride levels in the blood. We find grouped atrophic fibers in six of seven patients. So we're not convinced that these patients do not have that, and this is in newly weakened muscles and many pycnotic clumps. We find type grouping, and this is a patient with severe disease, weakness, trouble swallowing, and respiratory difficulty who made a spontaneous recovery and is doing well after a self imposed a psychosocial program of personality change. Here's grouped atrophic fibers. More of the same, just illustrating, and this is the only patient in our series that had the scattered small angular fibers that were talked about, and he was just recently diagnosed, and so we feel that maybe the recency of diagnosis was playing a role in his case. One of our patients had severe asthma and a peripheral neuropathy with loss of myelin fibers and a vasculitis and responded to prednisone. And this patient has had a deterioration, an improvement, a deterioration, an improvement, and a deterioration. So we have actually seen her come up and down, up and down. And it's interesting to note that that patient had similar changes in her leg and head holding at the same time, suggesting that we were dealing with a systemic metabolic disease or some other influence on the total motor system, not just the parts of the motor system affected by the old polio. And that was her leg and head holding. I just want to reach the conclusions. In conclusion, the post-polio syndrome and ALS are not related, and we think that post-polio has much better prognosis and slower progression. Since the post-polio is a syndrome about which we know so little, a detailed evaluation of patients is required in each and every case, and we recommend biopsies of muscle and nerve in addition to all the blood tests that I recommend in my article. And we feel that autoimmune phenomena are much more common than would be expected by chance alone. And this may be a hint about a possible etiology of the condition. And in some cases, the autoimmunity presents opportunity for treatment. Thank you.
Five minutes for questions, I think, before we have to break.
Munsat, Boston. I think we have three different views about the progression of post-polio syndrome. That's progression in terms of muscle strength. Dr. Delakis has reported a 1% per year decline. You have just reported a 7% per year decline in all body muscles. And our data suggests that there's too much noise in the system, too much fluctuation to detect a pattern. One question I think we have to ask ourselves is, what is the evaluation system we're using? And I would suggest that head holding and leg holding and even the MRC scale, the 100-point scale Dr. Delakis uses, is neither reproducible or reliable, nor is it valid in the sense of measuring what we're trying to get at. And I think it's important for us in describing change to define what the reliability of the test is in terms of mean and standard deviation. Now, if a patient loses 7% of baseline strength per year, that means at the end of 7 years, that patient will have lost 50% of muscle strength from the point he started. And at the end of 10 years, it'll be 70%. I think that clinical experience doesn't show that to be the case. So again, I would caution about being careful of the evaluation system we're using to make sure it is doing what we think it's doing.
The system that we use, we think, is reliable. And we have published our inter-observer correlations are extremely high. So that the head holding and leg holding is reproducible, and we've demonstrated that.
Let me comment on that. You know, correlation is not what it seems to be. For example, if you have a scale where you rate people as only 1 or 2, then you're going to get a correlation of 99.9% in terms of intra and inter rate of reliability. So one has to be careful about correlation coefficients.
I agree with you on what you said about the MC, the Medical Research Council scale. We don't think this is quantitative at all and doesn't reflect real numbers at all. So that we think that there are defects in all data, but the numbers came out 7% per year on the average for the patient, and for what it's worth, that's what the numbers were.
Tony Windebank, Rochester, Minnesota. Can I take issue with you about the tests that you recommend doing in all patients? That seemed like a very extensive battery of tests, particularly serial nerve biopsy. I think the concept of doing a serial nerve biopsy in every patient, if they don't have any clinical evidence of peripheral neuropathy, is both over-invasive and not cost-effective. Could you justify that?
Yes, we think we can. And if you look at the case reports and my written summary, we think that we did not biopsy every patient, but we did biopsy patients who had slowed sural nerve conduction velocities. And in that case, I think the yield is high. And we think that it made a major contribution to the therapy of some of the patients where we thought we were dealing with a non-treatable post-polio syndrome, and it actually turned out to be something that was inflammatory and treatable.
I have a comment and a question, Brostoff, London. In the post-viral syndrome patients I see, there are quite a high proportion of polyendocrinopathy, and I speak of Hashimoto's disease, evidence of anti-parietal cell antibodies, and others. You actually said there was a significant incidence of autoimmune phenomena, but presented no data. I find that sad. If you'd like to summarize it.
We have the data is in the written report. We have about 37%, and the type of abnormalities, each patient has multiple abnormalities. They usually consist of abnormal antibodies, including antithyroid and antimicrosomal antibodies, elevated or depressed serum complement levels, anti-acetylcholine receptor antibodies, and things like that. But these are all outlined in the paper.
Bradley, the thing that bothers me in about this presentation of variability of strength and in the other one suggesting a diffuse or systemic abnormality is the susceptibility of those tests to things like emotional state of the patient and things like this. That certainly would explain a uniform rise of all of the parameters in the patient at any one time and a deterioration at other times, just as much as some systemic autoimmune abnormality would. And I think one's got to exclude those sort of phenomena before you really go off into inflammatory disease and so forth.
Well, the patient comes back and says they are now returned to work and doing climbing stairs and eating better, and their grips have doubled. We think that's an improvement. The patient thinks it's an improvement, and they brought a big gift thanking us. So we consider all of that very cogent clinical evidence that a significant change has occurred, and whether it's psychological or physical, I don't care.
Pazishpur from Washington, D.C. We know that when a patient has some abnormalities of movement, such as post-polio patients might have, that might affect their structure of their peripheral nervous system. And the question comes up that if you're going to biopsy these patients, which leg do you choose? And how do you feel justified removing the remaining sensory problem that, at least the problem that the patient does not have, and giving him new sensory problems in addition to his motor disturbance that he might suffer in the same leg with polio?
We don't think it's a big deal, and we think it can be accomplished without much disability. In fact, it's difficult to detect sensory loss in that little toe after sural nerve is removed because of the overlap of the sensory system. So we think the problems are only in your head and are minimal, and that it's worth doing. And don't forget, the more we do, the more we learn. And sooner or later, we have to learn what's causing this problem and what to do about it. If we just sit back and do nothing, we're not going to learn anything.
I think we're going to end at that point. We're going to have to take our break. We have 2 hours of program. I'll remind everybody afterward. So I would suggest we reconvene at 4 o'clock sharp.
This is the end of tape 3 and concludes this portion of the program.